All right, man, welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 690. Jason Lingren is with me, and we're going to tackle communism. Anyhow, I think Jason almost got a hurricane yesterday. Welcome, Jason.
And a very hot good morning, and yep, it just happened to shoot south of us, so maybe a little rain will hit us later today.
It's a thing. First name storm of the season this early, and as I told you, I saw someone looking at the radar maps claiming they were pumping moisture into it, but it was a non-event, thank God. Anyhow, anything you want to mention about the communism notes that you have written here?
Well, we're going to go through a lot of history, and the one thing I can say that I'm seeing today that really disappoints me is just how poor of students of history too many people are. Communism has never worked, never come to anything good, and has led to the deaths of literally tens of millions of people.
It seems like every generation, this kind of thinking, this communal thinking comes up. It's crazy, but I don't know if you agree with me. If you look at where we're going, this new technocracy, as people are calling it, to me, it's the closest way to describe it is like some bizarre form of technical communism. I mean, do you think that's a fair stab, or would you define it in some other way?
Probably pieces of what communism has been. I look at it more as like a neo-feudalism.
That's pretty good, too. You got to get the tech in there, though.
Right, because it's going to be very tech-oriented.
I mean, 100%. What we're seeing now is the data centers. And if you've even paid any attention to it, they're using the old strategy, you know, ask for forgiveness later. They're just doing everything they can to get these things built. Doesn't matter who they're stepping on, what rules they're breaking. And it's a bit crazy when you consider that, well, on the one hand, they're telling us we're running out of resources. There's too many people. On the other, climate change, pollution is a big deal. These data centers are the worst of the worst. I looked up that some of them use hundreds of millions of gallons of water a day. The pollution isn't even completely known yet, but it's pretty clear they're massively polluting. The point I'm making here is if you think back to the 80s when we saw things like the Terminator, that's what we're looking at here. These are the anchor for the Skynet in real life. And all these camera systems, to include the flock, are like the tentacles that will be out feeding the data enforcement. But I don't want to pull us too far off. Let's jump into communism.
Communism is a political and economic ideology that advocates for a classless, stateless society in which all property and wealth are communally owned. It seeks to replace private property and a profit-based economy with collective ownership and the distribution of goods based on individual need. Core principles include common ownership, where major means of production, such as factories, farms, and resources, are owned or supposed to be owned by the public rather than private individuals. The ultimate goal is said to be a classless and stateless society by eliminating social hierarchies and the state apparatus entirely. There is distribution by need, where wealth is distributed according to the principle. Quote, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. The modern theory of communism is said to be largely rooted in the works of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, particularly Critique of the Gotha Program, which is released in 1875, and the Communist Manifesto, released in 1848. In Marxist theory, communism is viewed as the final stage of societal development, following a transitional socialist phase where the state controls the economy to overthrow capitalist structures. While communism in theory envisions a society without money or government, in practice, countries that have adopted communist systems, such as the former Soviet Union or present-day China, have actually operated under single-party authoritarian rule. In these historical models, the state, rather than the public, owned and controlled the means of production, often resulting in highly centralized command economies. Just to be totally real here, a theoretical stateless, classless, communist society has never actually existed. It has, however, caused death and misery for literally tens of millions of people in places that have implemented some form of it.
And this is what's so crazy about communism, and it keeps coming back up, socialism, which has been called communism in slow motion. And as Jason just pointed out, typically thought of as the step before you get there. There's been no version of this that has ever worked. And, you know, I'm thinking about films that might cover this. The only one I can think of, Jason, is Dr. Zhivago, where it kind of supposedly shows Russia going down into the communist state. But the funny thing is one of the main tenets here is, oh, the people own everything. Well, look at every version you can look at. What's a better way of saying that is the people own nothing. It's like a completely locked down state. But in Zhivago, one of the early scenes is a doctor lived in a big old three-story house. And when the Communist Brotherhood comes in, they're basically saying, well, we counted your square foot and there's enough for this many families in here. And they have like 100 people packed in there. They're sleeping on the stairs. The main point here, as Jason said, there's no version of this form of supposed governance anywhere ever that worked.
Looking way back in history, hunter-gatherer societies exhibited primitive communism, as per Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, with shared resources. Roman Stoics, like Seneca, idealized a golden age of common bounty without poverty. In Plato's Republic, circa 380 BCE, the elite guardian class would share property, wives, and children to foster unity and prevent corruption. Aristophanes parodied similar ideas in The Assembly Women, a comedy play written in 391 BCE, which portrays a scenario where the women of Athens assume control of the government and institute reforms that ban private wealth and enforce sexual equity for the old and unattractive. And finally, Zoroastrian reformer Mazdak, circa 500 CE, promoted religious communism during the time of the Sasanian Empire in Iran.
So right now, the biggest version of this that I guess we can see is China. And what's so kind of scary about that, and probably the absolute dream of the so-called New World Order, or whoever it is pulling the strings to this digital concentration camp they're trying to build, is in that situation, basically one person snaps their fingers and whatever it was that was said is implemented the next morning. When you come over to this country and you see how things work, it goes to the house, it goes around, nothing gets done quickly. And that's kind of nerve-wracking when you see the state of the world now and you know for a fact that China wants to do something, they just snap their fingers and it's done. There will be no oversight. There will, you know, it just happens. But I think, you know, that's really the only version I can think of right now, Jason, that matters. Can you think of another?
No, not really. And this is what always happens with communism. It always turns into an authoritarian dictatorship.
Well, there have been rumors for, I don't know, a couple decades about China where there are claims that the ruling circle of head communists are taking all the organic food and things like this. So if it's true, then the corruption, you know, these people that are supposed to be communally sharing everything are in power and they're hoarding all the best of the best.
Well, again, this is what always ends up happening when you look at the history of it. There's always a small elite class that ends up with whatever they want. And they live in luxury and no one else does. That's the complete opposite of what this supposed communism is supposed to be.
Many of the people who assess where we're going towards what I call the digital concentration camp say that it's communism at its end. That remains to be seen. But if communism is such a great idea, how come there aren't endless versions of it we can look at right now that matter, I would ask.
And the people who want it, or at least say that they want it, are usually the lazier parts of society thinking they're going to get a free handout. And sorry, doesn't work that way.
No, what you get is punishment that is usually severe and rules like you can't imagine.
Looking at early Christianity and medieval Europe, New Testament passages such as Acts describe early Christians holding goods in common. Monasticism preserved communal living, Groups like the Waldensians from the 12th century, Begards from the 12th through the 14th centuries, Apostolic Brethren Dulcinians circa 1300, Lollards, who were followers of John Wycliffe in the late 14th and 15th centuries, and Diggers, who were led by Gerard Winstanley during and after the English Civil War from 1649 and into the 1650s, all advocated or practiced communal property, often facing persecution. Taborites during the Hussite Wars in the 15th century also briefly enforced community of goods.
Community of goods. Let's keep pushing.
There were several pieces of utopian literature that should be mentioned that came out in the 16th through the 18th centuries. First, there is Thomas More's Utopia from 1516, which depicts a society without private property. Tommaso Campanella's City of the Sun from 1602 envisions shared goods, eugenics, and scientific rule. Enlightenment thinkers like Jean Mestier, Abbé de Mable, Étienne Gabriel Morelli, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau critiqued private property as the root of inequality and vice. Lastly, the late 18th century French writers Victor de Huppé and Restif de la Breton used early forms of communist terminology for utopian blueprints that emphasized communal living and property sharing, marking an important bridge from earlier Christian or religious communal experiments to what could be considered modern socialist communist thought. They did not advocate revolutionary overthrow or class struggle in the Marxist sense, but focused on practical, small-scale, philosophical communities that were inspired by Rousseau and others who had radical critiques of civilization, theories of the social contract, and arguments for popular sovereignty that would go on to influence modern political, economic, and educational thought, and is even said to have helped spark the French Revolution. They were also inspired by physiocrats, who were an 18th century group of French Enlightenment economists who founded the first scientific school of economics, and who believed that agriculture was the sole source of all wealth and advocated for laissez-faire policies, arguing that economies operate best under natural laws without government interference. And finally, they idealized natural or primitive societies.
It's a bit ironic that all the early versions of what we're talking about try to point to some utopia. And that's another bizarre effect of all this. It's never come close to any of that. But it occurs to me, Jason, as you were reading through the history, that when there's a certain class of people who get all the money or all the goods, talk of communism starts to get along a little bit better. And look where we are now with the billionaires. I think, didn't I hear recently that one of them's about to be a trillionaire or something like that? It's these kinds of situations that cue up the conversation for communism. And if that goes down, to me, that's just more of the social engineering at work.
Elon Musk is now supposedly the world's first trillionaire. But for a lot of the loonies who like to scream about how terrible that is, that's not that he has $1 trillion or more sitting in a bank account. It's the value of all his stocks and wealth because he's into so many companies that are highly successful. It is what it is.
These are the arguments when the perception of that extreme wealth, when everyone else is having a hard time, that seems to grease the skids for the ideas of the fake utopian communism.
Well, they think that because someone has that kind of wealth that he should be able to wave a magic wand, throw money at something, and all of a sudden that problem goes away. It doesn't work that way. There's too many people involved. Elon Musk can't single-handedly fix any of the world's major problems. It just doesn't work that way.
I mean, when we look at what's going on now, and you know where I stand, we are absolutely going into a new era. The problem is that the people with power knew the era switch was coming, so they're trying to sway it in the direction they want. But to me, that pretty much dictates that most of the systems we have known are going to go away or drastically change what they've ever been. And that's hard to accept for people don't like change. But again, the people who have looked at the New World Order ideas swear up and down that this goes to communism in its last stages.
The revolutionary era which lasts roughly from 1789 to 1799 during the French Revolution, provides fertile ground for radical egalitarian ideas to move from theory to attempted practice. An economic crisis, Enlightenment critiques of inequality, and the radicalization of the revolution, especially the Jacobin phase and terror, fuel demands beyond legal equality and property rights toward material equality and communal ownership. François Noël Gratius Babeuf, who lived from 1760 to 1797, emerges as the central figure to attempt to bridge the ideas of utopian communism and bring them to revolutionary action. He was born in Saint-Quentin to a poor family, with his father being a tax farmer and deserter. Babeuf would work as a foudiste, which was a legal specialist who documented feudal dues for lords. This role would give him intimate knowledge of peasant exploitation, which he would later turn against the system. He adopts the name Gracchus after the Roman reformers Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, who championed land distribution. By the late 1780s, he corresponds with figures like Dubois de Fossaux on communal land and industry ideas. He is imprisoned in Arras during the early revolution, and he studies radical Enlightenment thinkers, especially Étienne Gabriel Morelli's book Code de la Nature, which advocated that communal property is natural law, as well as the writings of Gabriel Bonnot de Mably, who wrote critiques of inequality being rooted in property. These would influence his shift from reform to communism.
You know, look what he's doing. He's saying this is natural law, but it's really not, because the way you put communism together has little to nothing to do with nature. And again here, you know, you've tracked it all the way through here, Jason. They're going all the way back to Rome again, the people that are trying to frame up the ideas for this. Truly, all roads lead to Rome.
In the early 1790s, Babeuf moves to Paris, supports the ongoing revolution, and works in administration. By 1793 and 94, he commits to economic equality. He criticizes Jacobin policies, but remains sympathetic to Robespierre's Republic of Virtue. In July of 1794, after the fall of Robespierre, he opposes the moderate directory's rollback of radical gains, rising prices, and bourgeois enrichment. He founds the journal Tribune of the People, which agitates for the poor, attacks speculators, and serves as the public face of his underground network, which is likened by historians to Vladimir Lenin's political newspaper, Iskra. In 1796 comes the Conspiracy of the Equals, which was a secret plot to overthrow the directory and establish a proto-socialist republic. This represents the last major Jacobin-style uprising and the first organized attempt at a communist revolution. Betrayed by an informant, Georges Grisel, in May of 1796, leaders of this society are arrested. The trial at Vendôme, which runs from February through May of 1797, is lengthy and public. Babeuf and his allies defend their principles eloquently, framing it as a fight against tyranny. Most were acquitted, but Babeuf and his ally, Augustin d'Arthez, are guillotined on May 27th, 1797. His other allies are imprisoned or deported. Babeuf goes to the scaffold shouting revolutionary slogans, which cements his martyr status because, despite his failure, his efforts pioneered revolutionary communism, which encompasses secret organization, transitional dictatorship, and total economic equality being the final goal. It remains a foundational chapter in the history of leftist radicalism, marks the shift to revolutionary and not just utopian communism, and would later be praised by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels.
Probably not the best idea in the world to have publicly guillotined this guy, but here we are. In the history of this country, actually for most of my life, the political ideas that you saw on television were hardcore against communism. And the reason I'm pointing this out is because we don't even detect this attitude anymore. Jason, do you? I mean, all my life it's been, we'll do anything we can to stop those damn Reds. My whole life, the main enemy has been that communist Russia. We've got the blackballing of Hollywood a little further back. But all through my life, the idea that was public was communism is bad and we'll fight it with everything we've got forever. And we don't hear a peep about it anymore.
Well, that's because, as Dr. Coleman told us, the way they were going to try and take this country out was through the left side of politics by infiltrating certain organizations, especially places like education. And they've done a pretty unfortunately good job of swaying public opinion way towards that direction now.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner. I mean, that's really the point. You just put the period on the sentence. Because I don't even, in my mind, I can't even really think when that conversation ended. Last time it was like a big deal. I don't know, maybe the 90s, I'm guessing, but it's absolutely under the carpet now. And we have the rise of the first trillionaire. You can almost detect the little rose in the garden being prepared for planting communism seeds.
We are now in the 19th century, and we will see the foundational theories of Marxism coming to be. Karl Marx, who lived from 1818 until 1883, and Frederick Engels, who lived from 1820 until 1895, developed modern scientific socialism, which would later be called Marxism, by synthesizing earlier utopian, radical enlightenment, and economic ideas with a materialist analysis of history and capitalism. Their work shifted communism from moralistic or small-scale utopian experiments to a theory that is grounded in class struggle, historical materialism, and inevitable proletarian revolution. Considerable bloodshed and misery would come about as a result of these ideas. Both Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels worked together to create Marxism and is considered a collaborative, intellectual, and political project, and not just the work of Karl Marx alone. While Marx is the deeper original theorist and primary author of the most foundational economic critique, Engels is an essential co-founder, co-author, popularizer, financial supporter, and posthumous editor who helps to shape, systematize, and disseminate what will become known as Marxism.
They're going to give the whole idea a facelift, but again, the words they're using are absolutely contrary. They're using words like enlightenment and utopian, and it's like furthest from the reality of what we can see. And again, I thought of a couple more movies that illustrate, this time in China, when communism was taking over. One of them is The Red Violin. It's actually a good movie, but it shows the path of this violin, and part of it is through China as it's turning. The other one, and this is hard to watch at times, called The Last Emperor, where they're showing the life of the last emperor of China. In both cases, they give you a pretty front forward-looking view of what happened when communism came in. And it's hell-bent, to say the least. I don't know. Have you seen either of those films, Jason?
I haven't, but yeah, when these systems come in, terror, abject misery, torture, death, forced labor. I mean, you name it. Anything that's bad comes with this system.
Right. In the Red Violin version and actually in The Last Emperor, starving, they claimed, I don't know, a million people starved to death or something. It's horrific, to say the least.
Karl Marx is born on May 5th, 1818 in Trier, Prussia, which is now Germany, and is the oldest surviving son of 9 children. His parents are Heinrich, a lawyer, and Henriette Pressburg, who come from Jewish rabbinical families, but converted to Protestantism, specifically Lutheranism, for professional and social reasons, amid Prussian anti-Jewish laws. Marx would be baptized at the age of 6. He attends the Friedrich Wilhelm Gymnasium in Trier, then studies law at the University of Bonn in 1835, where he is known for a boisterous lifestyle that includes drinking, dueling, and some minor arrests. His father transfers him to the more rigorous University of Berlin in 1836, where young Karl shifts toward philosophy and joins the radical Young Hegelians and earns a doctorate from the University of Jena in 1841 with a thesis on the ancient Greek philosophers Democritus and Epicurus. He does some early journalism for the newspaper Rheinische Zeitung in 1842 and 1843, which leads to its suppression by Prussian censors, which pushes young Karl toward radicalism. In 1843, he marries Jenny von Westphalen, who is the daughter of a Prussian baron and is his longtime love. The couple moved to Paris, then Brussels, and eventually to London after the failed revolutions of 1848, which were also called the Spring of Nations or Springtime of the Peoples. These were a massive wave of liberal, nationalist, democratic, and socialist-inspired uprisings that swept across Europe from January of 1848 and into 1849, affecting over 50 countries and territories, which makes 1848 the most widespread revolutionary year in European history. In Paris and Brussels, Karl develops his materialist conception of history called historical materialism and critiques capitalism. He meets Frederick Engels in 1844, which is the beginning of a lifelong partnership. Together, they will write works like The Holy Family in 1845 and The German Ideology in 1845 and 46. Karl Marx is said to have lived in poverty while in London, being supported largely by his friend Frederick Engels, as well as occasional journalism, such as for the New York Tribune. He suffers from health issues, such as boils and liver problems, as well as family tragedies. Jenny dies in 1881, with Karl following on March 14th, 1883, being buried in Highgate Cemetery, London. Of their seven children, only three daughters, Jenny, Laura, and Eleanor, will survive to adulthood, with Eleanor becoming a prominent socialist activist. Karl combines rigorous analysis with revolutionary commitment, though he never holds power and often struggles personally with debt and exile.
So you hear this tragic story, and yet he is one of the two major names in communism, the other one coming later with Lenin. And so how? And I'll tell you where my suspicious mind goes right now. I've done a lot of work on social engineering, and I know how far back it goes. And if I know how far back it goes, it probably goes further back than I'm aware. And given the, how should I say it, family line that he came from, I'm going to question if he was intentionally put into the game and that this was all a socially engineered getting communist ideas on the map. And that's going to be far from what most people are thinking. But Jason, as you laid down his early life and everything else that followed it, and then you kind of wrap up with, but he was poverty stricken the whole time. He died. They were eating breadcrumbs. And yet, he is the major name in communism.
Right. Well, I just always thought it was quite ironic that this guy who's critiquing economic systems didn't do very good with his own economics.
Right. I mean, he's almost a forgettable individual. And actually, the early part where he's out dueling, that was a thing in Germany, by the way, if you had your dueling scar. And also, look at Tycho Brahe. He lost his nose. What was he doing? He was dueling. But anyhow, let's move on.
Friedrich Engels is born on November 28th, 1820, in Barmen, which is now Wuppertal in Prussia, and comes from a wealthy, pietist Protestant family of textile manufacturers. His father owned factories in Germany and England called Ehrmann and Engels. Friedrich is expected to join the family business, but he rebels against its strict religious values, instead pursuing radical ideas through self-education, literature, and philosophy. He serves in the Prussian military in 1841 and 1842 and is sent to Manchester, England in 1842 to manage the family firm. There, he witnesses industrial working-class conditions firsthand. In 1845, he publishes The Condition of the Working Class in England, a detailed exposé based on observations, statistics, and worker interviews. This work provides empirical grounding for later Marxist analysis. Friedrich meets Karl briefly in 1842, called by Friedrich later as a cool encounter, and reconnects decisively in Paris in 1844. They discovered that they have complete theoretical agreement and begin a partnership that will last until Karl's death. Friedrich co-authors major works, including the Communist Manifesto in 1848, and participates in the 1848 revolutions fighting in Baden in southwestern Germany. While running the Manchester business, which he did until 1869, Friedrich financially supported the impoverished Karl and his family for decades, enabling Karl to focus on writing. After selling his share, he lives comfortably and continues aiding Karl's survivors. Post-1883, Friedrich edits and publishes the remaining volumes of Das Kapital, writes influential popularizations like Socialism, Utopian and Scientific in 1880, and authors The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State in 1884, in which he applies materialist analysis to anthropology and gender relations. He remains active in the international socialist movement, advising parties and corresponding widely. Friedrich Engels dies of throat cancer on August 5, 1895. Per his wishes, his ashes are scattered off of England's coast.
I mean, I'm going to ask the question, was the onset of communism wholly part of the global social engineering? And if you look at what's going on during this period of time, we have the Industrial Revolution coming in, and it's no secret how bad conditions were for workers. Wouldn't that make a very ripe field for these utopian ideas as they're being described, where everyone is equal and all the language that tries to sugarcoat the reality of what we're talking about? I mean, what do you think, Jason? This is all coming to be right when you couldn't find people more unhappy if they were in the working class.
Well, right. But I actually see like the opposite of that. All of the industrial control that was in place really kept people in just some sort of feudal serfdom anyway. Instead of working the land, now you worked the factories and you kept people down. I don't really see why any global control system would want to disrupt that. They already had control for the most part.
Well, see, I'm not saying it's a disruption. It's the form of control. You know, it's just a form of government. I'm not suggesting it would remove that. But I mean, I totally get what you're driving at there, because it is a form of feudalism. I just suspect that if you looked through history, you probably couldn't find an unhappier working class than as the Industrial Revolution is described to us. Not only for how horrid it was, because before that, everyone was out in nature working. Now they're enclosed and with all these machines and everything. I don't know. To me, the whole thing smacks of social engineering.
And again, we're now talking about the time of the robber barons, which we have covered, and they most assuredly fought to keep the systems in place as they were, and they had the money to really do a good job of keeping things the way they were so that they could keep their control.
Right, and that's actually another thing that they're broadcasting right now. I don't know the name of it, but on HBO, there are the robber barons being portrayed in Newport, Rhode Island when they're on vacation and in New York. I know it covers the onset of lighting the city for the first time, but I'm also aware that there's a point where all the workers were standing up to the robber barons. And what really happened was people got beat down by the Pinkertons and shot. But in one of the versions they're showing, the magnanimous robber baron stopped the Pinkertons, or might even been the National Guard, from shooting down the people. The point I'm making is they're even flaunting on television now the robber barons and trying to paint them in a better light.
Friedrich Engels is not considered a mere sidekick to Karl Marx, as he provided empirical data, organizational skills, financial stability, and popularization, while Karl Marx supplied deeper philosophical and economic depth. They collaborated as equals on core ideas, like historical materialism. Engels often described Marx as the greater genius, but was indispensable to the development and spread of what became Marxism. Both men are considered to have been brilliant, committed revolutionaries whose personal lives involved hardship, exile, and family devotion. Their intellectual output reshaped global politics, and not for the better.
I guess there was no room in the branding because everybody knows Marx. Very few people have heard of Engels. When you say the name, they're probably thinking Little House on the Prairie or something. But isn't it ironic that they describe him as maybe more important than Marx in some way, and almost nobody's ever heard of him?
It's ironic that as much as Karl Marx was shouting against capitalism, it was only because of capitalism that there was financial assistance available to him from his buddy Friedrich.
right? And then what do we say about that? Where he didn't have to work. He got to do what he wanted because someone else was working.
Exactly. And that's communism. That's it exactly. Well, some socialism too. It's like somebody else is going to do the work so that you can benefit. Nailed it. That's it. These people are freaking hypocrites, and it disgusts me. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels put forth the argument that history is not driven by ideas, great men, or moral progress, but by material conditions and, more specifically, changes in the way that societies produce and distribute goods. This is called historical materialism. At every stage of history, society ends up being divided into classes with opposing interests, whether that be masters and slaves or lords and serfs. In the more modern era, the terms bourgeoisie, or capitalist owners, and the proletariat, or workers, would be used. Class struggle is, therefore, the engine of historical change. They sharply distinguished their ideas from earlier utopian socialism. Utopians dreamed up perfect societies and then tried to convince the rich to adopt them. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels believed that they were offering scientific socialism, defined as a rigorous, evidence-based analysis that showed that capitalism would inevitably collapse under its own contradictions, just as feudalism had collapsed before it. This has never been proven to be true, of course. In Das Kapital, especially Volume 1 from 1867, Karl Marx laid out what he thought was his devastating critique of capitalism. Workers would produce more value than they are paid in wages, with the difference being surplus value, which the capitalist pockets as profit. Quite honestly, I don't see the problem here. Regardless, Karl felt that this creates exploitation that is built right into the system. Workers would become alienated from their labor, from the products they make, and even from each other. Capitalism also suffers regular crises of overproduction, falling profits, and growing inequality. These contradictions, Karl Marx predicted, would lead the proletariat to develop class consciousness, overthrow the bourgeoisie, and seize the means of production. After the revolution would come a transitional period that would be called the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is a term that Karl Marx used sparingly, during which the working class would use state power to suppress the old ruling class and reorganize society. Eventually, once classes disappeared, the state itself would wither away, which would leave a classless, stateless communist society, one where the principle, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, could finally be realized. This never, ever works.
You know, when you look back at what we're laying down, I swear this smacks as communism have been dreamt up somewhere and then implemented, however it was implemented. We're covering the historical way it supposedly happened. Nothing it says has been true. The utopian ideas, even the main thesis for the supposed reworked scientific version, what he predicted didn't happen. Nothing collapsed. It's all based on nonsense, and every time it's implemented at a time when everyone's unhappy. There's monetary imbalance. Few have a lot, many have less. And then this idea gets painted however it is, and it's brought back in. It smacks to me as a social engineering idea from the very beginning, before there ever even was something we could call communism.
Well, this has never worked the way he dreamt in his little head about it.
Right.
What always happens is there's never a classless society that comes about from instituting his ridiculous ideas. You always have two classes, no matter what. A tiny elite who have a lot and live in luxury and have almost all of the power, and then everybody else whose life basically sucks. That's what always happens. And then they're completely overlooking the fact that innovation, especially when it comes to things like science, comes a lot from the concept of competition, which comes from capitalism, from companies competing with each other to do better and achieve their goals.
And the freedom to implement, right? That's part of it. I mean, if you're locked up or limited in some way, that competition will not happen in the same way. But look at Russia post 1989. I mean, they've ripped down the statues. My point is, they're not proud of that part of history, are they? They ripped down the statues. They've walked away from it. So if you wanted to view communism as a test in Russia, I mean, even the people who were there ran from it when they had the opportunity.
With all of what we just covered in mind, in 1864, Karl Marx played a leading role in founding the first International Working Men's Association to unite workers across borders. It was torn apart by fights between Marxists and anarchists, especially Mikhail Bakunin, who was a Russian revolutionary, philosopher, and the most influential figure in the development of modern anarchism. He became Karl Marx's chief rival in the socialist movement of the 19th century, particularly within the First International. The Paris Commune of 1871, which was a short-lived revolutionary government that ruled Paris from March 18th to May 28th, 1871, or about 72 days, is widely regarded as the first major modern attempt at a proletarian or working-class government. It is said to have become a powerful symbol as well as a cautionary tale for both Marxists and anarchists, as it ended up being crushed with horrific violence. What had happened was one of the bloodiest episodes in 19th century European history, as during Bloody Week, May 21st through May 28th, government troops went in and recaptured Paris street by street. Communards built barricades and executed hostages, including the Archbishop of Paris. Versailles troops responded, with tens of thousands killed or executed. Karl Marx, of course, hailed the event as the first real example of proletarian power, even though it was not of a purely Marxist philosophy. Its defeat taught future revolutionaries the need for tighter organization as well as ruthlessness. Marxism offered a powerful intellectual framework that would inspire labor movements worldwide, yet it also contained seeds of authoritarianism, as the idea that a temporary dictatorship would be necessary, combined with the belief that history was inevitably on their side and would be used by later leaders to justify immense suffering. Karl Marx definitely got the suffering part spot on.
It's almost like they came up with an idea that can sound good when described in certain ways to certain people, but there's absolutely no hope of ever implementing it in the real world. And when you get to the point that you just laid down with the authoritarianism, what do we know about power? Power corrupts. Absolute power absolutely corrupts. So if one of the steps in what you're doing here is authoritarianism, how are you ever going to get out of that? You know, the whole thing is flawed. And the only part of it that works is it seems to sound promising on paper. It's ridiculous.
It's always just been a paper thing. It doesn't work in reality. Human beings require motivation to do and achieve anything. Communism wipes that out completely.
Well, it's interesting now because the main one that counts is China, and they have entered the technical phase of the world. We'll see if people are going to be happy there.
We now enter into the 20th century. Russia at this time is a vast empire, but is also described as being rather backward, since this empire is still rather largely feudal, with only a tiny industrial working class. There is widespread peasant poverty and an autocratic czar, Nicholas II, who believes he rules by divine right. The Russo-Japanese War, which ran from 1904 until 1905, was a humiliating defeat for Russia and one that exposed its government's incompetence. On January 22, 1905, a day that would come to be known as Bloody Sunday, a peaceful procession of workers, led by Father Gregory Gapon, marches to the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg to present a petition for better conditions and reforms. Troops open fire, killing hundreds. This massacre ignites nationwide fury. What follows is the most widespread unrest that Russia had ever seen, with massive strikes occurring, said to be over 2 million workers at its peak. Peasant revolts that burned estates, naval mutinies, the most famous taking place on the battleship Potemkin, nationalist uprisings in Poland, Finland, the Baltic states, and the Caucasus, and the formation of Soviets, or workers' councils, which are elected bodies that coordinate strikes and act as alternative local governments. Leon Trotsky becomes a key leader of the St. Petersburg Soviet. In October of 1905, a general strike paralyzes the country. Tsar Nicholas II is forced to issue the October Manifesto, promising a constitution, civil liberties, and an elected Duma, or parliament. This temporarily calms the situation. The 1905 revolution ultimately fails, but it does serve as a crucial dress rehearsal for what will be coming in 1917, as it radicalizes a generation and deepens the split inside the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Vladimir Lenin's faction, called the Bolsheviks, or the Majority, emerge as the most hardline group, who insist on a tightly disciplined, professional, revolutionary party that is ready for armed struggle. The more moderate Mensheviks want a broader party and a slower, democratic path. Lenin takes the lesson from the 1905 failure that the liberals and bourgeoisie would always betray the workers the moment that they get a few concessions. That belief would shape everything that would be coming next.
So the only public-facing version of this I'm aware of is the movie called Dr. Zhivago. It's either from the late 60s or early 70s, probably the 60s. And the Bolsheviks play a role, and they do show you just how down and dirty the whole thing was. Meanwhile, with the winners they have, this point that we're talking about here, there is a whole underground story of the role the banking, the European bankers played in this that we're not going to touch on. But I just figured I'd throw it in because it is a big part of the story, just not so easily covered.
By early 1917, Russia is collapsing under the weight of the First World War. Millions of soldiers are dead or deserting. The economy is in ruins. Cities are facing bread shortages, and Tsar Nicholas II has lost almost all support. The pressure finally snaps in February of 1917, or March by the Western Gregorian calendar. Spontaneous strikes and protests in Petrograd, which is now called St. Petersburg, over food shortages, turn into a full revolt. Soldiers refuse to fire on demonstrators and begin joining them. Within days, the Tsar abdicates. The 300-year Romanov dynasty ends almost overnight. A provisional government comprised mostly of liberals and moderate socialists takes power, promising democracy, continued war against Germany, and eventual elections. However, real power on the streets increasingly belongs to the Soviets, or workers' and soldiers' councils. This creates dual power, the provisional government versus the Soviets. Lenin's Bolsheviks are the most radical in the Soviets' faction.
And they're not playing games. I would estimate that when the soldiers refuse to fire on their own people and then join them, the jig is absolutely up. Anyhow, that was a pretty finite run through the history of communism. What do you want to add before we break for the first hour?
Well, when we get back, we will go through just how they pulled off this insanity in Russia to become the Soviet Union. And we will be touching on other countries as well that have gone this way. And of course, always, always, always failed.
I suspect if the people who predict where the New World Order agenda goes, and it is communism, that we'll never really hear those words to describe it. Because it's not respected at any level anywhere, so it'll probably get a different moniker. But there it is for the top of Hour 1. We're going to take a short break. Hour 1 is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. Members get access to all the forums and comments sections. They get exclusive access to my solar filming, which, by the way, finally this year, I have been able to fire up the scope. I have my first three-hour animation captured the other day. Lastly, you get exclusive access to Shoot the Moon. It's free to all membership and not available outside the site. With that, we're going to take a short break, and I'd like to wish everybody a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
belief is the enemy of knowing.